Should have control over information about themselves, not so they own it, but control it. And then how are you able to authenticate various claims that people make about themselves, and how do you create an identity system that is interoperable? Because really the NEP was intended to have an identity layer. It's very naive, sort of assuming a village atmosphere. So a lot has changed from that. And I think that how one deals with identity question is essential to basically the questions that precede it. The ability to have any kind of cloud law is going to be predicated on having a robust identity system. So we have a number of speakers or participants who've been very active in this space. Unfortunately, you'll see the list, Marshall Van Alsten, he got swine flu, so he's not participating, so he's in seclusion. But Jeff Gardner has agreed to step in. And what I'd like to do is sort of begin with Sandy. Okay. Talking about rich data. I want to tee it up a little bit, because little perspective, there is a lot of work now that's being done in identity. There's a notion of open ID, there's something called iCards, the government's been experimenting in this. The president talking about the cybersecurity review, recognizing the importance of identity. So these things are now moving front and foremost. We're talking about government 2.0. Again, we have to deal with identity correctly. And I think Sandy brings a perspective on identity, rich identity, that is quite disruptive and disturbing, but and very profound. And because even if sort of the whole paradigm of how looking at identity authentication is brought forward so far, it actually, this is another extension, a modification of it, if that's fair.
Okay.
Okay. You're on.
Advertising. Great. So just a couple words at the beginning. So some of the things that I've said so far are thinking about cloud as very particularly including all the mobile devices, cars, phones, things like that, that aren't usually the things that people think about when you're in IBM or Google or something like that. But those are computers too, and they're particularly important because they touch most of the 6 billion people in the world, and whereas sort of the PC sort of office model touches a relatively thin slice of the world. So that's one thing, is integrating those two types of computer networks. But the other thing is that phones and cars and things like that are sensor platforms. They know where they are. They have to in order to be able to work. They have microphones and accelerometers and pressure sensors and all sorts of stuff that let you do things like, you know, map the weather, know where the people are, predict traffic jams. But you can also do a lot more. And so there's this thinking of it as this cloud as actually being more like a nervous system, where there are sensors and actuators, and it's all connected together. And it's not the computing part that's interesting particularly. It's that. And the idea that these mobile devices could be part of a control system versus to make your car go in the right place or to keep you from having bad things happen to you. So that's the sort of mindset that I come from. And I want to show you some things that are around rich identity. So just to set that up, you know, if you get a government security clearance, if you give a government document, you have to show your passport, right? But if you want to get a security clearance, they go and talk to all your friends. And if you want to get a high-level security clearance, they talk to your friends since the day you were born and maybe your parents' friends. So it's not about the sort of key that you present in the document. It's about the relationships that they use to verify your identity. And one thing about this sort of nervous system is that begins to allow you to see all of those relationships. So let me just show you an experiment we did. We gave out phones to 100 folks at MIT in the business school and in the media lab. And over a period of a year, we watched as they moved around and did things. And just from a couple days of data, you can do very high accuracy at saying who they will say are their friends, who they will say are their family, who they say are their bosses. You can even tell with decent accuracy who will be friends in 6 months, just from patterns of association. I can tell you more about that, but I'm not going to get into the technical detail. Just, it's a social microscope, okay? You can do all sorts of things with it that should freak you out, but very easily. You can have very high accuracies in predicting your light patterns. We are not very variable animals. We are very patterned animals. So I can watch the first couple hours of your day, and I can predict what you will probably be doing by the end of the day and with who. With very high accuracy. And if you give me a little more data, I can do it with really disturbingly good accuracy. And as a guy who got all the face recognition stuff and a lot of other biometric stuff going, this is more accurate than that. Even without all the relationship stuff, this is more characteristic of you than your fingerprint, your face, your voice, by a lot. Not only that, but it has a certain element that's hard to fake because of the relationships. So for instance, if you happen to be sleeping, if you wanted to steal my identity, you know, you'd have to do things with this way of looking at things, like you'd have to sleep in my bed. Because that's what I do. And my wife, I don't know what she'd do, but she'd know that's it. Right? So don't go there, right? Okay. So might not notice, yeah. So there's this notion of understanding you through your relationships and your behavior. And you can call that identity, but it's actually a little more general than people think about it, because I think it's also the core of customer relationship management. It's the core of every system interacting with you and your preferences. It's knowing about you, and everything about you depends on this rich sense of identity. So let me just give you some examples. So these are people moving around in San Francisco. You can pick out the hot spots. Those are places like restaurants and bars that people like to go. And when you watch people doing this for a while, what you notice is that it's not just random motion between these spots. They're flows. So there are subpopulations that really don't talk to each other very much. They're like tribes. And while they may be physically in the same spot, they don't go to the same restaurants. They don't go to the same bars. They sometimes live right together. They have very similar demographics. In fact, you can't tell them apart adequately using transaction history, where they live, gender, age, income level, things like that. But you can tell them apart by behavior. And if you combine this sort of data with, let's see if we can go to the next one here, with, say, for instance, traditional demographic things about business. So now you know these people associate with these other people and not with some other folks, and that they spend time in these sorts of businesses, and that they live in these sorts of places. You end up with this network of relationships between the people, the other people, where they hang out, what those things do, where they live. And it's this incredibly rich sense of identity which lets you know not just who the person is in the sense of identity, that's this person, but you also know a huge amount about their preferences. So this is something that appeared in Business Week 2 months ago on the cover as the next net, referring to the next World Wide Web. So I would say that you might want to think about this as what that cloud is doing. What that mobile sensor cloud is doing is building this sort of network, this sort of relationship network, that you can then mine for doing all sorts of things. This is just a very simple graph. There's lots of them like this. But basically, you can predict people's behavior in the future. So will they change carrier? Will they buy this? Will they buy that? Typically, two times or more accurately than you can with traditional customer relationship management things. In other words, you are your behavior. You are not your demographics. And so we can predict a lot of things about you from this, not just who you are. I'm not going to say too much about that. All of this should scare you a little bit, because all this data is out there already. And so I've sort of, by chance, have sort of fallen into the role of a beyond privacy advocate. And the way I've sort of approached it is to argue that we need to go beyond traditional thoughts about privacy and create a market for this sort of information so that it can be monetized and regulated and controlled. And roughly to treat this sort of data the way you treat money, right? With the same sort of first-class object. And that starts with ownership rights.
So you have to clarify the ownership rights in these things. We were talking last night, some things there's co-creation and joint ownership. Some things, I pay somebody like the cellular company to use their device. I would say I own that data, not them, even though they have to have some access to it. But it's basically establishing the ownership rights, I would see, as sort of the first step forward for regulating this type of a thing. And I just want to also emphasize just one last thing at the end. We do a lot of things in my lab looking at startups and health services and things all around the world. And really thinking about this as this sensory network that covers all of humanity is really interesting. We don't know who lives in favelas. We don't know where they work. We don't know where they die. But you could if you start looking at this data. So it's interesting to think about. And that's it.
just to tee it up a little bit. I mean, so a person has a distinct signature based upon their behavior.
Yep.
They can be identified, predicted. You can use that to authenticate who a person is.
Yeah.
And at a certain claim. Now, so you have things like Axiom and Equifax, and all of those are collecting and making business out of that. And banks being dependent upon it. So this is a whole new data source.
Right, it's a whole new data source that just from the sort of face statistics are more powerful than biometrics or traditional methods. So they're more accurate in that sense. And they have other characteristics which make them very hard to fake. So that's two things going for them. And part of the proof that they're powerful is that you can use them to predict all sorts of other behaviors from it, right? That's basically it. It's this new way of looking at it. And I like the fact that there's this symmetry with how you get a security clearance. I mean, if it's really important that you're this type of person, you know, the FBI will go back and check your babysitter when you were 1 year old and say, did he cry too much? I mean, you know. So with this type of data, you can watch people's behavior over time.
But who aggregates that data and links it to you?
Well, that's what needs to get worked out. That's the million. So I have an idea about it,
yeah,
which
yeah.
is a which is sort of a trusted third party that is a lot like a bank. I know banks have a slightly bad, you know, reputation at the moment, but this is really dangerous stuff, basically.
Yeah.
When you start aggregating all this stuff, it's you know, it makes everything else pale. It makes 1984 look like you know, unimaginative. No. So a trusted third party that has ownership by people that whose reputation is on the line for doing it with it well.
Yeah, this trusted third party, I think this is where some of the conversations about the digital corporation comes into play. And some of the things that I thought about from the earlier moment, which is you got this new information currency, which has a value that becomes a lot like money. It could actually transcend money and become a new form of how we do interchange. But you have this trusted third party that needs to exist, because if you look at it from a business standpoint, you have the banks and you have platform providers and you have the telcos, and there's a few other people that would like to imagine they could be in this space too, but those are the people that control the data. They all have kind of business model implications for trying to go after this because of the big brother side of it, so it could be brand killers for them. So again, it makes you think towards a new type of entity that's going to be trusted advisor, trusted service provider for each of us to help maintain this information. But then I think where it goes further is that imagine then that corporation is actually owned by all the members. So you could say that, you know, is any corporation actually going to be able to do that? Is anyone going to be able to be trusted that much? But imagine then that you govern it with this digital corporation, and every single person that's putting in this information is getting value out of it. And so the rights of all the people that are involved in there. You know, then you look at it from the players and stewards standpoint, and then you can have the mindset that you will actually own your own data in the future, and the companies will not own it. And when we say companies, you can think of this digital, you know, corporation as being the owner of it, but it's actually owned by the people. So then that provides the framework to provide services back to all the people that currently mine this information, but allowing
all the members of the corporation to actually get paid to provide a monetization framework, which I think is going to be the key that makes this work. It's okay, so now you can have hundreds of thousands of analytics providers that swarm around this cloud and provide you all kinds of things, like you need to walk here, you need to go down these steps instead of taking the elevator because of your health, you need to shop at this location, you know, all types of things that you can subscribe to based on this information. So from that, you know, one of the questions that were in here that I think are also of interest is how might this vary internationally? And so when you think about the conversation we had earlier, the main kind of complication that I see is that I believe that this cloud structure will emerge and will actually move past borders. If you look at Facebook, I don't know what the numbers are now, it's the sixth largest country in the world. I think it was
Facebook.
Yeah. So imagine for a second that Facebook actually became a digital corporation. So what does that mean for the US borders? What does it mean for sovereignty? What does it mean for the laws of all these countries, and how will they actually have to advance? And imagine then that all that information then is owned by a digital corporation. Is it a US corporation? It has members all over the world. So actually, where does it actually reside? Here in the US? Is it China and India? Is it in multiple places? So again, I mean, I think, you know, to some of these questions, who are the likely players and stewards? I believe that it's actually going to be an emergent model that ties in very tightly with this, and the actual stewards are going to be ourselves and be a self-governing system.
To what extent do you think that sort of the government, that they're relinquishing a lot of their traditional authority and allowing that to happen? To what extent, you know, this seems to go against our earlier discussions about sort of the regulatory interventions and the role of the government would play. I mean, and you're sitting at the, when you really went to center of future of banking, I mean, you're looking at from BLA perspective, I mean, how do you see that playing out?
Yeah, I mean from the bank's perspective, I led the information strategy for the company for a couple of years before doing center of future banking, and we're looking at, you know, at the time, I mean, banks still have an incredible information advantage. I mean, because they see all these transaction flows. But what this Sandy just showed you is that advantage is eroding quickly. You start to do these mashups, you start to get a better view of what people are doing. And so I think, from, you know, while I was at the bank, what we looked at was is how do you kind of leverage this information capability and take it a step further. So really, and I think we're going to talk about it after lunch, but you know, right now banks are information about people's money. That's really all they are, zeros and ones. But in the future, would do banks become information about people, not just their money? So then going back to the trust side again, the banks hold enough stature from a trust perspective. They're certainly global in nature. They're not supranational companies like Google and Facebook and others, but they have the capability to transcend borders. So.
But I think one of the keys, though, is you have to set up this tension where this stuff becomes powerful when you put it all in one place, and then it's also when it becomes dangerous. And so what you need to have is you need to have something where the people that are participants have a very strong interest in using it correctly, right? Not using it in abusive ways. So their reputation, their business model has to be on the line if they're going to participate. So as an example, right? If the bank wanted to use this sort of information to, for instance, predict repayments on mortgages, that's fundamentally like redlining. It's illegal. Okay. On the other hand, if there was a trusted third party that was a reporting mechanism, the bank could possibly have part of it, the telco could have it,
CDC
could have part of it.
Right?
All of them, the reputation of all those organizations depends on the data being held and used appropriately.
Would you have multiple of these entities so people could go in and out? I mean, so you can have competing entities like this? I mean, so that people can, because if it's a monolith.
I don't know, but one answer is it's a little bit like the banking system. Data is valuable, so you put it in safe places, which have a dynamic towards safety, right, because of reputation. Yeah, you could have competing ones, but remember that the power comes from the concentration. It's not like you can have the repository for New York and the repository for Massachusetts. That's not any good.
Now, just to get something, this is a little bit of a term, but now imagine for a second that so you got this digital corporation, it's got tens of millions, potentially billions of people that are involved in this corporation, worldwide network. Now imagine for a second, how do governments actually deal with that? So do they put together Kalea Act type stuff like they did for the telcos, and they come in and they're going to put their pinchers in it, be able to pull out that information through different types of subpoenas? How does that digital corporation react to those requests? So I think that's how the governments actually become involved.
That's a good segue.
I'm sort of a question because you use the word identity.
Yes.
I'm not fully sure whether we're talking about one of two forms of identity. One is sort of a claim about oneself, and the other is essentially a data dump of everything about me. Right? And as I heard Jeff talk about it, it's that we're going to give a third party a data dump of everything about me and trust it to make all possible inferences. Is that...
I was saying two things. I mean, I think it's both. And there's another part that I didn't really even mention, which is the convergence of physical and virtual spaces. And a lot of this has been talks centered around virtual spaces, but what Sandy's showing here is increasingly physical spaces, and it's the touch point between the physical and the virtual. So I think it is, the identity part around who you are, and you make those claims and assertions. There's some things within that package of who you are that can be changed and you can modify. There's some things like your behavioral traces that just are. The way that you modify them is through your actions, not by going in and making an annotation or making a change to it. I mean, you can change your address, you can change, there's some things that you assert, some things that you can't.
So in the case of a study at MIT by some students that said that you can predict when somebody's gay by not actually knowing whether they're gay, but knowing who their friends are and whether they're gay with 90% accuracy or some number like that. So if you're in that, if you're in that 10%, if you're in that 10% and you want to assert a claim that you're not gay, there's no data that you control that you can do that. It's all the data of your friends. So you basically got to dump all your friends and get that validated in order to get that inference not applied to you, if that's the standard for measuring whether somebody's gay.
Right, possibly.
Definition of identity.
Well, let me just back at the classic notion of identity in terms of identity systems, and you want to authenticate that you are who you are in a physical sense, a personal identifying you, the biological me. I think there's that a root identity that you have, and then you can have different identities linked to that could be authenticated and anonymous with respect to certain kind of attributes that can be claimed that you make about yourself that some other third party could stand behind.
Maybe the other alternative, which I don't know if you're going to discuss, is the possibility that identity is a completely obsolete concept that should never be used anymore because
it is
fundamentally, identity as a, Clark Rockefeller, who we're all familiar with, it didn't really matter whether his name was X or Y. Did he do the D?
But there's a biological, there's a biological persistent person, Clark. They may call him Clark or whatever, the other name is Gara. But there is a physical person who is Clark. But there's a big difference between the naming of something and the thing itself. I mean, and it shouldn't be
that. Yeah, but I'm saying that when you start doing, Sandy doesn't talk about identity, he talks about inferences, right? And so inferences
make that link.
If you take that from Sandy's initial point about security checks, government security checks, if you've ever had one, they all drive to the same point. Can you be blackmailed? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the point. That's all they care about, really. Ultimately, can you be blackmailed? Mm-hmm. And because whether you're trustworthy and whatever, no one can test
that. Somebody gets on you. Right?
Yeah. Well, sometimes they also look at you, whether you are somebody who has an even temperament.
somebody can be relied on not to fall apart or do things. Depends on the physician.
Right, but those are all secondary to can you be black.
Why don't we give you a chance with the Department of Energy and dealing with some real issues about how the government should deal with that. And I know, as I said earlier, they're experimenting, but they're thinking about different kind of identity systems. It'd be great to get your perspective on that.
Well, some of these issues you're talking about are these far from right there in terms of what should go. I can't imagine the uproar that would occur if the government attempted to participate in it, some of these things that you're talking about here. So we're involved, obviously, in some of the more straightforward sorts of things. Governments, looking at how we determine who our own people are. The researchers are involved in the Sugar Project, and then in Common, which is a group of universities using the Sugar Field. Some of the other groups are involved in a little more tightly dedicated systems. So they can trust each other's identities. Then the question is, how do you move that on? Some of these other issues. But so it's not quite as, at least the things I've been talking about, they're quite as far ranging as but it's still trying to set up a foundation.
Would you see there being a government, a coherent government policy on identity? I mean, when you had the cyber review that came out, and actually you prepared a paper for that.
Yeah.
And the point being is that one of the big security challenges, I mean, not only is it cyber security and attacks and issues, but a security challenge is inability to share information across different agencies and get equivalence of claims and authentication methods. Hence, you have all these little silos that exist in the government. Do you see it in an effort to change that? Do you think the government is going to lead in that? I mean, just looking at HSP 12, they kind of sort of what they exist. Do you see that it's going to move into online, or are you sensing that? GSA is doing various things as well.
I think a lot of the agencies would like to move forward on that. This would be using these cards that you're talking about. You know, I'm simply plugging into my computer and recording it for a short period of time.
Right.
That would be the authentication. The databases would be able to be federated in a way that would allow you to move from one agency to another. But we're talking about longer range citizen identities.
The voting cards.
Much higher.
And you see voting cards coming in. You had the real ID debacle.
Yeah.
But do you think there's going to be pressure on the government to have a national ID at some point?
In those areas, you probably just pressure to cover measures.
Or de facto pressure. We can open up for a few questions if people
I'd like to just ask if there is some more depth that we could get to on David's question, which is the difference between the authentication one, the identity of an individual as a person versus the identity of the properties of the individual. Because a lot of those things that you're talking about are require us to actually have different words and understanding between those two concepts. So identity as a member of a community, being gay, is one thing, and then the other thing is the one you're talking about is authenticating the individuality.
Yeah, technically, you don't use the term identity. I mean, I think identity, depending on what community you're in, but that when you try to identity as to the biological person, not necessarily a property about them. And you can have a claim that someone makes about you having a certain set of attributes. The question is, how reliable is that claim? So that, and the validity of that claim would be to what extent the Gaydar thing is a valid.
But I thought that the point about the cloud law part is that both of those forms of identity are deeply important to the law in cloud.
Oh, yeah, they are.
Because, like, are you a member of Al-Qaeda? Well, that's a property about you, but that's...
Right.
And that's part of your identity.
It's being brought
crucial to your graph.
Yeah. It's a claim about you. It's a claim about you. And you have multiple claims. You can say what age you are, or, you know, arguably there'd be a set of services that will validate different claims you make about yourself. So Equifax will do that with respect to income and residence, things like that. So in a cloud law sense, you have multiple claims in different contexts. To what extent those are reliable claims and what are the provable claims? You know? So,
in New Zealand, just to throw a complete loop in everything, in regards to identity, it is legal to have multiple identities, real, actual, multiple identities, different names, different set of facts, that sort of thing.
Why should it be?
And what they do is they have some interesting constructs as to how they do identity verification for that reason. They actually did a similar architecture to one that I designed, because I was trying to handle medical records and the illegal alien problem, mm-hmm. Which ends up also being a very similar issue in regards to validation and authentication. So just to throw a little bit more chaos in there.
What is that approach?
Huh?
Or, I mean, what?
Basically, it had a lot to do with the mutual ownership aspect, where everything was encrypted and you needed both keys to actually get to the data. So with the medical data, both the patient had the key and the doctors had the key, and the doctor's key was also, could be part of a larger, where the doctors could actually give that key to other doctors or to, I was actually a nonprofit entity that brokered all of that, because the problem is the nonprofit orgs have to document all of their patients, but they don't have a good way of doing that to keep them anonymous, and so it was to facilitate that.
I think it makes an interesting point around, you know, it's the different, you know, layers of the onion. I mean, if once you tie a physical person into their virtual, you know, state, you know, whether it's the point that they're at today and then all the interactions that happen past that, then you can create, you know, pseudo alternative identities based on the fact that you can always track it back to that one person who has certain things that they can and cannot do. So you can provide that anonymity in a new kind of way, much like what you're saying there.
Yeah, I actually have this concept of Switzerland becoming the anonymous identity brokers system they do in banking.
Right. Tom, sort of building on that, I wanted to go back to this question of international law. And you asked the question of would governments be willing to give up the powers to do a lot of this kind of regulation. And I'm just kind of thinking about this. You know, what's politically feasible is one thing, but just trying to think of what's ideal in some conceptual sense seems to me at least useful kinds of input to the discussion. And it seems to me that there are some things, some kind of aspects of law that are naturally the domain of geographically defined governments. That is, anything that has to do with physical presence is probably naturally the domain of a geographically government. So enforcing laws about murder and armed robbery and burglary and doing things like fire department, police department, all those things are presumably natural functions of a government defined by its geographical boundaries. There's another set of things, especially information things, which are not, it seems to me, naturally the domain of a geographically defined government. So everything that happens on Wikipedia and Facebook and, you know, for that matter, the telephone network and a whole lot of other things, it seems to me, are things that in some sense naturally occur in cyberspace, not physical space, and should be regulated by some entities that are defined in cyberspatial terms rather than physical terms.
But what happens is, get back to Sanders' example. I mean, so you're driving cabs around, you're very physical, you're in San Francisco, and you have a profile, and someone gets murdered, they want to find out where you've been.
So
that under what jurisdiction?
Yeah, it seems to me that a really interesting question is, what's the interface between these two domains? So one reason why you need an interface for sure is that to enforce things,
yes,
to enforce regulations, ultimately you need to be able to touch the physical person.
Then you need some kind of keys. I mean, there could be keys and transfer keys, mm-hmm, that people have, that they have a warrant, therefore they, and then they get access to a key, and then they get a
right. So the geographical government might provide a service of physically arresting people,
right,
when they violated a law in a cyberspace regulation.
Greg?
So I want to sort of get reactions to three scenarios, right? So the first scenario, when I was watching Sandy's presentation, made me think, what would I like to see my own activity for the last 3 years? Because I realized, maybe I don't even know who I am. So maybe I wouldn't even recognize myself if Sandy gave me a sense of, this is you, and I said, well, that's not me. I went to that place. I didn't realize I went there, you know, every week. So the kind of the usefulness, the utility of the identity itself, and the assumption that, know, every individual has, that we even know what it is, right? So sort of made me think that we don't even know what it is yet. So it's a tremendously valuable and exciting kind of developments that can happen in cloud, and law. The second thing is, it made me think of my nephew who had moved from Pennsylvania to New York. He had just turned 21, so he hit some threshold of laws between Pennsylvania and New York. He lost all his documents. So in effect, he was in New York with no identification. He could not, you die. And so that identity is there, and the family that wants to claim it, or seize it, or
yeah,
or see what it is, or know who that person was. And so, I just sort of throw it out there as kind of different ways of maybe thinking about it. You know, and going back to Jeff, the virtual, physical, and, embodiment, and then what shows up on the ground.
Well, following your ideas about identity, I have a question. Is identity kind of a result of my identity, my behavior, my social behavior, for example, my movement? Or is it maybe also something which can be designed? So we have this comparison between body and body as a part of the identity, and this digital or virtual identity. Then it could be maybe interesting what you pointed out, how we could shape this virtual identity to use it, or to make use out of it. Maybe it's a kind of a new currency, for example. Something, because all this data we looked at it's a body of unsorted information. It's not very useful. I think the question could be, is it possible or imaginable that we have a kind of virtual identity, which is really a nice package, nice design, complete image of my fourth dimensional life, so it's 3D plus time, and then I can go through this and can get a clue of what happened, who is me, and maybe I could sell that story.
Well, it's interesting, for instance, this type of thing is very valuable, for instance, for public health, because you want to look at your exposure to things. But also the habits that you have determine your risk factor. So it's a very concrete thing. I showed this to the head of CDC's IT departments, and he said, wow, that's important for us, because it determines a lot of your exposure, your behavior, your risk factors. And of course, that's a very nice concrete example of some of these things.
Mm-hmm. And you talked about the right to your own data, or the right to own your data, and I guess how are you thinking of data there, and how are you thinking of that right?
Well, so here's the idea that I have, which obviously has gray edges and some places where it has problems. That let's just take the cell phone as an example of something. So you generate location fixes and you generate call logs and some other sort of information as you go around during the day, and it's very powerful information. Now you're doing that using something built by a manufacturer and using a service provided by a telco. So who owns that data? My take on it is that I would like to see the consumer, the individual, have ownership rights in that because they've already paid for the phone and for the service. And they could cut into a relationship with the service provider and say, okay, service provider, I'll let you actually play with the data under these circumstances for a reduced rate, say, or some other sort of service. But I want to take a very sort of proactive, pro-consumer stance to begin with to create a market. Because if I own the data, then I can sell it to people, right? And I also have the right to determine, you know, how it's passed on. And I may have the right to bring it back. What I've been finding is that many companies, you know, Facebook among them, but also MySpace and some of the cable companies and things, are actually very fine with comfortable with the idea that the customers own the data, and they only use the data to be able to provide the service, and they keep an abstract model of it. So they don't keep the original data around, which entails liability, right? That's how you get in trouble, is you keep the original stuff around and some disgruntled employee does something bad. But they want to keep the sort of demographics, the behavior models around. And if you do that, right, you actually can't re-identify people from that. And that's where their value is, because that's how they know what cross-selling to do, what servicing to do, how to control churn. It's not through the original data. I mean, they have to have access to it at least for a short period of time. But there's no reason for them to keep that.
It's through aggregated. But you're thinking about that in the context of private commercial relationships. Because there are other areas where it could be in tension or conflict with transparency. You think about records of campaign contributions, which are online.
Sure.
Sales databases. There are lots of other information where data about oneself is out there, and they're...
So this analogy of information being like money, so we have this thing called taxes, right? And, you know, so render under Caesar. You know, so the CDC needs that information. You can't just own that information, sorry. You have to be able to render that up for public health, for the public good, and for certain sorts of transparency, for certain criminal things. And as you've been emphasizing, there's a lot of co-creation. There's another class of situation where you and I together create the data, and perhaps there needs to be shared ownership there. And then there's another class of thing like security cameras, where I can't imagine as a practical matter that you could assert ownership over what's in the security camera. But, you know, that also is sort of interesting because those tend to map on our traditional ways of thinking about privacy. So if we're in a public area, that tends to be where the security cameras are. And if we can't assert rights over that, that's probably okay because it's public. That's why it's called that, right? Whereas the data about what you do, how you move around, you know, in your life, in your house, and things like that, we traditionally think of as being very private. And so that's where sort of my advocacy of individual ownership of data becomes really relevant. Right. So it's not perfect, you know. But the key thing is actually asserting ownership rights, whether they're joint or individual, because then you have the right of determination, and then you can begin creating a market.
But if some people opt out, doesn't that since everything's about relationships, certain percentage of people opt out to save rights to their data, then you don't have a picture of the relationships anymore. You have a pretty flawed picture. If your wife opted out and you didn't, that would tell a completely different story.
There gets to be some limiting cases. So, for instance, if almost everybody opts in, but only a few people opt out,
you can tell things about the people that opt out.
I worry about tying this to either the concept of ownership or the rationale that you have paid for the device. That kind of argument was used to defeat otherwise reasonable claims that employers ought not to be free to rummage around everything in the server that can track everything you do while you're at work, even though it would be uncomfortable if the employer demanded a right to search your desk drawer at any time for no reason, and so forth. And it seemed to me that because of the pervasiveness of the sensors, we might need to move to a state where we give up on trying to control access to the information and regulate uses of it, in effect. Saying there are certain kinds of unduly fine-grained, comprehensive pictures about somebody, however the data was derived, that it is impolite or illegal to show to or make available for whether commercially or otherwise. And to me, the way to control this is to think about what uses of data we want to prohibit rather than ownership of bits, whether they're aggregated or not.
I would second that. I was thinking that ownership, I would ask yourself the question, is ownership the paradigm you really want to borrow from to achieve what you're after? In traditional law of privacy, there's been a long-standing debate about whether it's a tort or an ownership or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a set of baggage that comes with what you're saying that may or may not be everything you're after. And I would second David's, it may be that it's something a little more idiosyncratic. There's power, there's rhetorical power and general notion that you're gaining certain kinds of control by saying, I own. But there's also other baggages and limitations that come with that label that may or may not be the thing you're after.
On that, because that's the concept that we were talking about a lot last night, coming from the technical point of view, the reason that we state things like ownership is so that we can actually go through and make sure that when we create these technologies, we have the metrics behind there so that we can go and layer the accountability on top of it. And so it might not always, and that way then you can actually start to define more in the legalistic sense of ownership as to, you know, what that accountability is going to be, what are the contracts that people have entered into, all those different aspects of it.
So what
but the technology itself still needs to have an ownership aspect so that you can have accountability.
I worry a little bit about regulating uses because there's a lot of sneaky ways to do things. It may be that it is just purely rhetorical, but it gives you a way to do just what you were saying. You say, this is a trace of how this happened. And at this point, it no longer matters. But before that, you know, here were the people that have stakes in the usage of this data.
But it may also be like, for instance, the difference between continental copyright or non-copyright and our copyright, that, you know, the kind of broad term, the rights of authors. Among other things, the ownership paradigm tends to say that you can waive everything, you can agree to everything. Oh, there it goes. Maybe you don't necessarily want that. The continental paradigm said, well, there were some things we just didn't make waivable in certain ways because that, and it wasn't an ownership marketplace approach. Ownership in marketplace is wonderful. I'm not saying it isn't, but it has particular kinds of characteristics that don't fit everything you necessarily want to regulate.
Sure.
And so I would just say from a starting point, it may be worthwhile thinking about other metaphors, other labels.
My own personal thing is I just want to have a debate about it because what I see is this stuff is happening, it's out there, and people don't talk about it. They don't appreciate how invasive or powerful or valuable as a public good this could be. And so I worry that there'll be real prohibitions against use, which means that the CDC can't use it, which means that you can't make the buses show up where the people are. They still have to run on stupid fixed routes.
Right. David, I'll let you give you the last word.
Sorry. Oh, Dave, that's fine. Good. Yeah, I agree with Sandy. The fundamental thing is to start having a conversation. I'd just like to make sure that we introduce two key things into the conversation that go unsaid and the conversation is starved for that. One is that I keep using the word inference because there are precious few actual facts in the world and there are quite a few inferences, many of which are not valid, right? Or only quasi-valid, and we treat them as facts nonetheless. So the fact that somebody appears in a surveillance camera is only qualified by the degree to which that person is actually recognizable in the surveillance camera, and there's a lot of interpretation applied to that.
I mentioned a couple of other examples. And the other is the degree to which we treat data as being in a container or in a place. It's not information theory. If you think about fundamental information theory, bits don't exist in a place. Bits are ultimately derivable from states of things, and those and maybe distributed through the states of things. So in a deep fundamental technical level, information doesn't fit in containers, so the idea of ownership that's associated with possession of the only container or whatever is becoming more and more bogus as we create a class, right? And so the idea that we premise our laws on containable flows of information, which is where computer security came from and so forth, and even where some of the interpretations of ownership come from, although you can apply ownership without having a container, start to get really problematic. Like, you know, it's very brittle, if not else. Once somebody breaks the container, you know, the game's over, it becomes public information, right? And we see that in, you know, I was told recently, because I was doing some work with some folks who were doing classified parts of the work, that even though I have no clearance, that I can be told that certain information is top secret, and I have to do something with it, forget about it. But and that's, you know, that's an analog of this. The information came from my brain. I invented it based on an inference, and I was told that I'm not supposed to know that. So it points out that information is slippery, and to treat it as a commoditized thing is especially becoming dangerous. And that's the ownership paradigm. You know, talking about possession, that is control. In the more theoretical aspects of the law, probably still works, even though information isn't in a container. But the lay rhetorical power of the argument that I control it and it's in my box and I only share it with somebody, that's over. The containerization is over, not the ownership.
That's the last word. So, all right, well, we can break for lunch. Thank you very much.